Hey everybody, welcome to the Green Divas Radio Show. You're on with Green Diva Meg.
And Green Diva Lynn calling from the basement.
Green Diva Studio South, sort of.
Underground.
Yeah, there you go. Underground. So, you know, one of the things we want to start doing more is really asking our audience to please interact with us, connect
please.
With us on social media. And
because we're fun and cool.
Yeah, we're interactive. We have fun and we love goofing around with our audience. But it helps us let us know you're out there. And you can ask us questions and all that fun stuff. But today we want to specifically ask you to please consider and go get. Don't consider, just do it. It's free. The GDGD Radio app. It's on all platforms for your smartphones.
Yeah, GD it.
GD
I don't know.
Go do it. I get it.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Right?
That's what it means.
GD it, go do it, or God damn it, go do it.
Both of them. Wait, why would you say that?
GD it. Anyway, it's free, people. Please do it, because, you know, we've got 24/7 programming that, you know, you can tap into any old time.
I like to say we're more like 72/8. It sounds...
That's a twist in math, isn't it? So today we have a couple of really fascinating green dudes and a Green Diva's Green Thumb segment. First of all, I had a little reunion with my green dude, Scotty. Who
beam me up, Scotty.
I know. We got that a lot. He and I used to have so much fun in the studio. He's very popular, but he moved up to Connecticut. And one of the things he's been doing is he works at an airport, small airport. Up there. That's his training from his Marine service, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But he connected with this gentleman who designed this solar electric plane. It's all no engine, no gas engine, no fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very cool. So
where do you plug in up there?
I know. Well, hence the solar, right?
Right. And that works if it's cloudy, too.
Apparently.
I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting interview, and I'm kind of excited. Like, I'm not into getting into small planes, but this one, I think
me
I
neither.
Want it. I want to do it. I want to do it.
Okay.
So
if you do it, I can do it.
We can do this. We can do this.
Is he offering to take us somewhere?
Yeah. I think we're going to get an offer to fly. I think he's in Colorado, but when he comes out east.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the other one was with Jay Nichols, Dr. Wallace J. Nichols, who we call Jay affectionately.
Everybody does call him Jay.
What a great
Not
guy.
Just us.
With the blue mind. It's
yeah,
all...
I met him when he came to Bering. He went to the same high school that my son's going to. He's an alumni. He came to give a presentation, so I got to meet him.
Well, he is all about how he's a marine biologist, but he's all about making the connection between water, you know, deeper connection. I mean, yes, we need water to survive, but there is an emotional and a health, mental health component
mm-hmm.
that
we
scientifically proven that we do react to water. So another reason.
I'm staring at my water right now to see if anything happens.
See? Well.
I feel better already.
I feel better already.
No, I know. It's like bodies of water, not just looking at.
Yeah, but this is just another reason that we need to protect our water. Our waterways, you know.
You don't want to be looking at water on fire.
And no, that's not cool.
Or polluted with plastic.
So listen to our turtle-hugging friend, Jay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a green thumb with Megan Kane about garlic, because now's the time to get that garlic in for next season.
I would never have known that.
Yeah, it's that time. And it's so freaking easy. You got to just do it. One of these days, I'm actually going to do it. So, with that, stuff your garlic in the ground, put on your headset, listen to the GDGD Radio app, and catch up on this and other wonderful shows. Please stay tuned. Lots more coming. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
Every Green Diva needs a sidekick. At the Green Divas Radio Show, they're called Green Dudes. Time now for a deeper shade of green from a guy's perspective.
Well, first of all, this is a very special Green Dude segment because I have my original, my very own Green Dude Scott back in the studio.
Yes, I've traveled very, very far from all kinds of hazards and byways to get here.
Right. From Connecticut. It's not that bad.
Well, it's been a couple years since I've been on with you. So
I know. We got to make this more of a habit, but you've been a busy guy.
Busy. Oh, well, we won't even get into that. That's a whole nother show.
Well, actually, we do, because part of this, what we're doing today, is we're talking about, work that you've been involved with that has led you to this fascinating gentleman that we're going to be talking to today.
Right. I've been involved in aviation most of my life. And one of the exciting things that we're seeing, as well as in the automotive industry, is electric vehicles, or using electricity to move us from point A to point B, which, if we really look at the history of any motor transport, it's not new. It's just better.
Right.
And we found a way to make it work.
Well, and this gentleman we're speaking to today is George Bai. He's the CEO of Aero Electric, Aircraft Corporation.
Correct.
And he's developed a solar electric plane, which just, I think, is the coolest thing ever.
Now, as we all know, we've seen the Prius, the Volt, and the Leaf. And of course, they had their original starts and critics and so on. But as everyone's... Actually, maybe a lot of people don't see them on the road because they're just cruising along with us.
Well, there's a lot more. It's become more common now. And there's a lot less fear about range. And they've resolved a lot of those issues. And there's more charging available. And,
Absolutely.
So let's talk to George. Hi, George.
Good morning. How are you?
We're great.
Now, the Sunflyer. Give us some idea. First of all, where did it come from? Where did you start with it?
Well, we have been working on electric aircraft for 5, 6, maybe even 7 years, starting small and growing up through the process with kind of a research and development of aircraft in increasing size. And we've been flying now this last year a single seat experimental aircraft, a technology demonstrator, with the basic electric components and things that we wanted to put on the Sunflyer. And as we proved those, we're now ready to begin. In fact, we're in assembly as we speak of the two-seat Sunflyer prototype. So we're very, very pleased with all these components coming together and being proved.
Right. Now, this the two-seater and from what I understand, is going to be used initially and is very useful as a trainer.
Yes. The trainer utility is particularly of interest for a number of reasons. As you may know, the training mission, the purpose of training in an airplane usually is captured in an hour or an hour and a half of flight time. In that period of time, the student has experienced, several takeoff and landing practice opportunities and gone to a little practice area and done a little bit of flying. But after you've flown for an hour or an hour and a half, that's about the limit, a practical limit, for a training mission or sortie. And so that's nicely aligned in terms of both the market need for a capable trainer, as well as the performance of this initial battery-powered aircraft, which has about a three-hour flight time. So what a wonderful match of capability with requirement. And, of course, along with the tremendous cost savings, which is such a concern for new students wanting to become pilots.
Sure, absolutely. So that's one of the
things.
What
an alignment.
Well, then there's the brilliant impact on, or lack of impact on, the environment. It's a reduction because...
Oh, it's immense.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's no pollutants. And in aviation today, we burn a high-octane leaded fuel. And how wonderful it would be to not have that requirement anymore. And not to mention the noise. As well.
Right. And of course, all airports have people that, despite knowing that the airport's been there for 100 years, move next door to the airport and complain about the noise, which is all my aviation buddies would agree and all nod in unison. But the very fact that now, one of the things that I'm sure, then we'll get more into this later, is the future of an electric aircraft, and it's, I mean, this isn't the only electric aircraft or solar aircraft that's being tested and out there. This is the first one, and correct me if I'm wrong, George, that's going to be out there in production for people to train in.
That's right. This is uniquely, this is the first that will be FAA certified. Oh. In aviation, we have the Federal Aviation Administration. And there's experimental aircraft, of course. There's research and development airplanes. There's military aircraft and commercial aircraft. All of them are governed by a process of safety certification, and the agency, of course, is the FAA that does that. Uniquely, we have, with all this research and so forth behind us, sat down and worked together with the FAA to arrive at a certification program that we have collectively agreed to, and we're very, very excited. We'll have the world's first certified
Well, that's a big deal.
Solar electric airplane for training. Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, one of the things that we touched on just a minute ago is the cost savings. Minimally, in my experience, it's about $100 an hour for flight training.
Yes.
Now, for the flight schools, the savings is huge because every aircraft that flies is required to go through an annual inspection. And that inspection includes tearing down the engine, making sure that engine is efficient and safe. I'm assuming that with this, without an engine and a lot fewer moving parts, that the annuals would be a lot less expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, the major cost of flying and flight training is the cost of fuel, and then the organization operating the airplanes, as you mentioned, maintaining the aircraft as well as fueling it. So the combination of annual maintenance cycles, 100-hour maintenance cycles, and the daily routine of maintaining an internal combustion engine is an expense together with fuel that all adds together to that $100 an hour of flight time cost that you just mentioned. With an electric airplane, the cost of fuel is merely, I mean this literally, about $1 per flight hour.
Yeah, that is amazing. So now,
$1.
I can see why, and in reading the article, that you've been working with the FAA to try to, present this plane, the Sunflyer, as a replacement for all these older training planes, and there's thousands of them. So that's really very cool.
Yeah, I think we're touching millions.
Right, okay. Now, do you have thoughts of expansion? Of course, I would. And making this more accessible to the average flyer as your battery capacity improves or your range improves? Do you have, obviously, research and development going on for that?
Yes, indeed. This is the first of a family of aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine, and I think we're all aware of this, as mentioned earlier, electric cars, of course, are becoming more available. The batteries are getting better. The charging stations are more available. People used to kind of chuckle about, those boxy electric cars that you can only drive a few blocks kind of a thing.
And, right.
And now no one's laughing anymore. I mean, they're commonplace. It's expected. It's becoming a part of our culture in a sense.
Well, let me just tell you, I have an electric car parked outside, and I was telling Scott before we started recording that I have put gas in that car 4 times. It also has a gas engine,
generator,
but
yeah.
4 times in a year. And it's a small tank. Just saying.
Isn't that amazing?
Amazing? I don't go all that far, but so are you like the Elon Musk of airplanes? You're gonna take this and really make it into the next generation.
We really hope that's what we're able to accomplish. I believe We will reflect on this conversation and others in the years ahead and wonder what took so long.
Yeah.
Now, let's, you know, considering the public's view of this, this is an aircraft. Its airframe is proven. It's nothing new. The only difference with this aircraft is how it is propelled into the air. And it's, and as we were just talking about, you know, electric propulsion or driving a motor which drives a propeller is proven. There's no mystery here. This is there's really no issues with this as far as it being a reliable, safe aircraft.
Right.
That's right. It's a synergy of a number of technologies all coming together at the right time. And not really possible before for a whole number of reasons in each of the various aspects. You know, we're certainly, it's advanced aerodynamics, but as you point out, it's still an airfoil. It's certainly an advanced structure, advanced carbon construction, very lightweight, very strong. And, you know, electric motors have been around for a long, long time, but certainly now becoming much lighter, much more capable, more kilowatts or torque per unit weight, certainly. And I think everybody agrees that the battery technology, oh my, I mean, yeah. How much has the battery technology advanced even in just 10 years or 5 years? And it, looking forward another 5 years, I think we have so much to, so much advantage to capture in the future with even greater capacity, which leads to, you know, more power and range and endurance and things. So
speaking,
we're very excited. This is we really believe the future.
Well, so speaking of capacity and range, I was thinking about the solar. I know you have solar built into this system. How much range does it offer or extension on the range?
So at present, the battery only is about 3 hours of time aloft. Flying time.
Okay.
Adding the solar aspect is another roughly 15%. Then we also use the propeller as a regenerative device, call it a windmill, in fact, and a motor, of course, is a generator. So that's another 15%. So the physics of flying, along with solar energy, which is absolutely free. What a wonderful thing
to have
a device that is able to collect this free energy as a result of being aloft, generally speaking, on nice sunny days. So we're very happy to have this supplemental capability through the propeller and through the solar panels that allow the airplane to fly even longer and give you both fun and flexibility and additional utility if you're in a remote location and things like that.
So let's go through a normal day for the Sunflyer. It's plugged in. The pilot walks out there, or student in this case, and flicks on a switch and sees that the powers are fully, or that the batteries are fully charged. Unplugs the aircraft. Flies it for an hour or so. Lands it. Plugs it back in, and it's ready to go. How soon?
Yeah.
Well, that. If you were to take the direct analogy to an electric automobile, that would be correct. And I think for many recreational flyers or individual pilot owners, that would be exactly what they'd do.
Right.
They'd plug it into a charger, a supercharger,
yep.
A nice conditioned battery system, battery charging system, excuse me. And that would indeed be the process. You know, you fly on the weekends, or perhaps midweek, you would come out to your plane and go for a pleasure flight or a business flight. In a flight school environment, though, we have a higher ops tempo. There's a, as you would typically expect, the instructor and student are going to come out to the airplane, and they'll fly that training sortie, and they'll come back, and the next instructor and student will be ready to go pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah.
So. Rather than a plug-in, what we do is a battery swap.
Oh, yeah. It's the Tesla school of battery swap.
And
I like it.
How much work is involved in that swap?
All a grand total of maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say it's pretty low stress, I'm sure.
It's very low stress, and it's the batteries are designed for that quick.
Okay, so I have never really wanted to fly a small plane until now.
Now, and have you seen it? The damn thing's sexy.
It really is. It really looks like it would float pretty nice if, God forbid. See, here in my thinking, I would plan my range to be half of the electric and use the other stuff as emergency, you know, right?
Well, glide? What are you talking about as a glider?
No. I'm just saying right. I would be planning to use half of the range on the electric, whatever you originally get. And then, you know, the rest of it's like if you need it, you know, it's there.
Well, majority of general aviation guys on a typical weekend, they're not going to fly more than 3 hours. Do you get out and, you know, most people don't sit in their car for 3 hours. So why would they need to do that anyway?
Joy flying?
So, well, that's what most of general aviation is. So, George, this isn't necessarily just a trainer. This could be for any general aviation pilot.
Oh, absolutely. Here in the Colorado area, you fly from Denver up to Aspen or maybe down to Colorado Springs or meet some friends up in Loveland or whatever it might be. And the pleasure of flying is possible again for a fraction of the cost without adding pollutants. The fun of flying is possible again.
So how can people find out more? We have to wrap this up, which I'm disappointed because I really just have a million more questions, but we have to wrap this one up. So tell us how people can find out more.
Well, we'd be delighted to speak with people, of course, and we invite them to go to sunflyer.com.
There you go.
And keep up with our progress and correspond if they'd like to. So,
when will this be available to the general public?
Well, we're flying the prototype very shortly. As I mentioned, the two-seat airplane is in assembly, final assembly, actually, right now, and we hope to be flying right at the end of the year, first of next year with that prototype. It takes about 2 years, maybe a little bit more, with the FAA from this point.
Sure.
So if you can kind of look out into the future, two and a half, 3 years, right in there, those first customer deliveries will be underway.
That's exciting.
Wow.
I can't wait.
It is. I'm so excited to hear this, and I can't wait to fly in one. You guys are going to have to take me up, one of you.
Certainly.
Yay.
George, I look forward to seeing you next time you're at KDXR, and thank you for speaking with us today.
Thanks, George.
Certainly enjoyed it. Thank you both so much.
Take care. Bye.
Want more information on this Green Dude segment and other ideas for low-stress green living? Go to thegreendivas.com. That's greendivas.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Orchards of crisp apples and juicy peaches can make for a sweet life. But fruit farmers like Southwest Michigan's Bill Schultz face growing risks and uncertainty. Schultz, a third-generation farmer, says that growing fruit in the Midwest has always been challenging, but the effects of climate change are making it even tougher today.
Those extremes have always existed, but they seem to be more prevalent these days.
Last winter's deep freeze was fatal to many of the fruit trees at Schultz's Fruit Ridge Farms, trees that also experienced destructive heat waves and extreme rains in the summer. So to increase his odds of success, Schultz is cultivating a wider variety of crops. In addition to the standards, apples, peaches, pears, grapes, and berries, his farm now produces asparagus, honey, maple syrup, Kraft cider, and even bison meat. So if one crop fails, hopefully another one will do well. But variety and versatility can only take farmers so far.
In 2012, we lost all of our crops. It does not matter what level of education or skill set I possess. The weather is above us all.
But Schultz remains optimistic that by hedging his bets with a diverse menu of products, his farm can make it through the bad years and thrive. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Wishing you had a green thumb or want to learn more about sustainable gardening outdoors and in? Expert green divas and dude gardeners share tips for everything from composting to growing herbs in your kitchen. Listen to the Green Divas Green Thumb for low-stress gardening tips. We're on again with this wonderful, smart garden lady, Megan Kane, who is a garden educator, spells her name properly, which I personally love, the creative vegetable gardener. And she's also an author, but she's the creative vegetable gardener is an online community all about learning different ways of gardening and vegetable gardening in particular. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Save me from my lame introduction, and let's get into talking about garlic.
All right. It's one of my favorite things to grow in the garden, and I think one of the easiest as well.
Yeah. I've done it in the past, but haven't done it recently. But let's talk about, because I guess it's the time of year that we're recording this is getting on time to plant it.
Right. So a lot of gardeners, especially in northern climates, I live in Wisconsin, so up there in the north, think that there's really nothing to plant anymore this time of year. And I always have to remind people, no, you can still plant garlic. So where I live in Wisconsin, we plant it usually mid to the end of October. Garlic is one of the only things that can survive the winter here. We have pretty harsh winter in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Survives fine. In fact, garlic really likes to have some chill over the winter. And so if you're in a winter area, it's a great crop to grow.
All right.
And it also gives you a nice payback, I think. So one time my sister called me, she's learning how to garden. She said, okay, when you plant one cabbage, how many cabbages do you get? And I thought, that's a really interesting way to think about gardening.
Yeah.
How much do you get for everything that you plant?
Right.
And so garlic is one of the great things because when you buy seed garlic, you buy a bulb that just looks just like the garlic that you buy at the grocery store, but you break it apart into the cloves,
yeah,
and then you plant the individual cloves, and they turn into a bulb.
Now, and when you do that, you don't strip the bulb down to the core, right? You leave the papery stuff around it, right?
Yeah, you can leave it. You don't have to strip it. All I do is break apart the bulbs, and so it's good to go to the farmer's market if you have a farmer's market in your area, or order the seed garlic online.
Okay.
And the nice thing is that you only really have to buy seed garlic once, and then after that you can just save your own seed from year to year.
Wow.
Some of the things in the grocery store are sprayed with like anti-sprouting agents. So it's nice to just go to somebody in your area. It also ensures that you're buying a variety that can grow in your area. So really my favorite sources for plants and seeds are farmers in my area.
Yeah.
So if you have a farmer's market and somebody's selling seed garlic, then you know that it grows in your area and that you'll be more likely to have success. So you can buy a bunch of bulbs either from online or from your farmer's market, and then you break them apart. I just kind of break them apart into a bucket, and then you go out to your garden and prepare your bed. I just loosen the soil up a little bit if you want to add compost or whatever you do to prep a bed in your garden. And then you take those individual cloves and you plant them 6 inches apart on all sides. So you can fit quite a bit of garlic in a pretty small area.
And how deep will you put the bulb?
I usually put them about 4 inches down. So put the clove, and you want the pointy side up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at a garlic clove, you can see there's a little circle on the bottom, which is actually where the roots come out.
Right.
So you want that little flat part goes down and the pointy part pops up. And 6 inches apart. And then I mulch my garlic bed with hay. I really like marsh hay. That's another topic we can talk about someday is mulching.
Yes.
But mulch it to kind of protect your soil from the winter desiccation, the winds, and then nothing else you have to do. It'll be fine. I live in an area where sometimes it gets down to negative 40 in the winter. My garlic survives just great.
Wow.
And you'll see in the spring, and for me it's usually in April, the garlic will start to to come up.
Yep.
Little green, almost looks like a flower bulb, will start to pop up through the mulch. You can just leave the mulch on. It keeps down the weeds and traps in some moisture, and then it'll just start to grow.
Now, so in theory, I could do this in pots on my deck.
You could, yeah. I would just leave them. You could leave them outside or put them somewhere where you know that it's going to be pretty cold, depending on where you live. So you don't want to put them in your basement because they won't get enough.
No, I'd leave them outside. I have a couple of I don't love plastic, but they're these large tomato. They were designed specifically to grow tomatoes. They're kind of large.
Right.
Hard to describe, but they would definitely survive the winter.
Okay. Yeah, it's a great fall task. There are a few. It's best not to just leave your garden as is when you head into the winter.
Yeah.
And so if you want to join me over on my blog, I usually send out one post a week. And we always talk about whatever's in season in gardening. And so this fall we'll be talking about all the things you should be doing in your fall garden.
Oh, I need to sign up.
Garlic.
So is that creativevegetablegardener.com?
Yep, creativevegetablegardener.com, right on the homepage. Folks can sign up for an email, and you'll get an email once a week all about gardening.
I'll be signing up, and I'm going to do my garlic this year, finally. I'm going to really do it now.
Yep, we'll talk a little bit more about garlic on the blog. And at our house, we actually plant between 220 and 250 garlic, and that's one of the things that we store just in our basement. And I never buy garlic. My garlic lasts all year round.
Yeah, I was going to say, you haven't bought garlic. No. Yeah.
We often have garlic breath, and then we never have to buy garlic.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you for another wonderful gardening segment here with some great ideas. And folks, even if you don't have a big garden, you could probably do this in a pot on your deck if you wanted to.
Yeah, you can fit a lot of garlic in a small amount of space since the spacing is only about 6 inches.
I think it's fun. Thanks, Megan.
All right, thank you.
Inspired to grow more organic stuff? We are. To learn more about this Green Diva's Green Thumb episode and all kinds of other great green information, visit thegreendivas.com. That's T-H-E, greendivas.com.
They are among the oldest animals on Earth and have the reputation for being one of the deadliest. But when it comes to sharks, man is the predator. More on that after this.
Everyone wants to be a part of the green movement, and that's a great thing. Going green takes on a whole new meaning when you add tall grass beef to your family's dinner table. It's tender and juicy, and since the cattle graze on the natural grasslands of Kansas, it's also loaded with essential fatty acids and omega-3s that regular grain-fed beef lacks. It's good for you and your family, and good for the earth. For more information and to order tall grass beef online, go to www.tallgrassbeef.com.
Recently, a 1,323-pound Mako shark was caught off the coast of California, the largest shark to be caught on a rod and reel. Each year, approximately 100 million sharks are taken from the sea, mostly for their fins. The act of finning is a brutal practice that uses only the fins, cut off while the shark is alive, and then the fish is dumped overboard, where it slowly sinks and suffocates. Removing that many sharks from the food chain can have dire consequences in the long term. These magnificent creatures have been on Earth for over 300 million years, but now their fate is uncertain. I'm Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm a little jealous because Green Diva Lynn got to connect with this wonderful gentleman, Dr. Wallace J. Nichols, who is a, you know, there's a long list here, so bear with me, right? He's a marine biologist, former senior scientist for Ocean Conservancy. He's an author of a beautiful book called The Blue Mind. And I think that's what we're going to talk about primarily. But among other things, he's also a turtle hugger. So let's ask Jay, and we'll call him Jay because that's what, you know, Green Divas call their friends. No, just kidding. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you? Just, nice to be on the conversation with you.
God, just getting goofy over here. Sometimes I just trip over my own self trying to do an introduction, so I apologize.
That's all right.
And
Jay it is. That's my preferred name.
Yeah, you know, because you are. You're like in the blue mind. We were chatting before, and I'm like, this guy is so peaced out. I really already like you. And, you know, I only know you through Lynn. And I guess you and Lynn originally had gone to school together.
That's right.
And recently you were doing a blue mind. Is it called a blue mind talk or a blue mind seminar?
Yeah, I was back in Illinois for a kind of a combination of my 30th high school reunion and what they called an Alumni Legends Award.
And, oh.
And we turned that into a fundraiser for the STEM program, the Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math program at the high school, and had a great evening kind of conversation on stage about science and being a young scientist and then what you do after that. And it was excellent. Really
wow. Now, I totally missed, like, all of that detail from Lynn, and that's, of course, why her son was with her partly. You know, you never know. Like, you got to turn on the youth that are in high school to pay attention to science nowadays.
Yeah, and reflecting back on those high school and even college years, and then, you know, kind of thinking about what were the formative pieces and who were the teachers and professors who kind of got under your skin and nudged you towards a career in science, and how does that even happen? It was kind of where we went with the conversation, and how do we do more? And how do we create more passion for science and the natural world among our young people? Certainly an important question to ask.
Well, a well-deserved award, no doubt, from the little that I'm learning here. But, you know, I was reading up on the work that you do, and Lynn said, make sure you call him a turtle hugger. Because apparently you do have a love of turtles, which, you know, as a marine biologist, obviously you become familiar with.
And the idea of kind of, I guess, admitting publicly confidently that you are a turtle hugger or even a turtle lover or a water lover or a whale lover or a, you know, plankton lover, whatever the case may be, just to say that and stand tall and not be ashamed that there really is an emotional component to all of this, and recognizing that as a scientist and even getting into the science of emotion is part of what I'm trying to do these days. And, I fell in love with turtles. I can't exactly explain why, but I like the way I felt when I was thinking about them and hanging out with them and learning more. And I wanted that feeling to be part of my life. And I think most biologists will tell you a similar story. And it may not involve turtles. It could involve ants.
Right.
It could involve, you know, the green parts of the world.
Right.
But we all fell in love with that feeling and with life itself. And we kind of stop talking about that as we get more serious and older and more professional.
Right.
But I think that's a shame. I think we need to keep it right there.
Well, that's the original passion, the connection. I mean, Native Americans might describe it as a totem or, you know, it's the connection that drew your passion out and made you want to think more about what is this and what is this connection. So let's go a little deeper into your book, The Blue Mind, and it's a whole philosophy that you're, you know, the science behind why humans react, and that we do indeed react. There is a scientific, chemical, biochemical reaction to water.
I call that feeling blue mind, and that's obviously a very simple name for a quite complex and diverse set of responses to water. And water in all of its forms, from, you know, when you wake up in the morning and splash a little water on your face,
right,
or drink a big glass of it, all the way on up to, you know, the Great Lakes and the great oceans, mm-hmm, and how they make us feel when we're standing at their edge, watching the sunset, or jumping in and going underneath the water, or skimming across their surface.
Yeah.
There is something special about how water makes us feel, not surprisingly, because if you don't have access to water, you're not long for this world.
Right.
And so there's a sort of a deep evolutionary connection to water that sort of precludes life and allows for life. It's the matrix of life. So that the idea that our brains, and in fact our whole nervous system, would be set up to position us correctly relative to water makes sense, and that there would be an emotional,
right,
chemical response when we are in the right place or in the wrong place would also make sense. So as a scientist, that I've not only lived that my whole life, I'm, you know, a water baby, and as a kid, like,
yep,
a lot of people,
yep,
you just couldn't get me out of the water.
I grew up with one of the only pools in town, and at 4 years old, my parents taught me to swim because they were always nervous that somehow I would fall into the pool.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it's because I'm Pisces or what, but I could swim literally all day long, and there was just nothing happier than pretending I was either a sea turtle or a dolphin, and, you know, it was a joy.
And you were popular because you had a pool, I'm sure.
And
that was kind of place people wanted to be, was at your house.
Yeah, it did help that, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, there's no question. There's no question about just standing at the edge of a lake or the ocean. It's a visceral shift in my consciousness almost.
Yeah, and so what happens to us is, you know, to get right into it, our breathing slows, our heart rate slows, the different parts of our brains are active or inactive compared to when we're, say, working on a math problem or driving in traffic or having a conversation with a group of people,
right,
or watching a movie, or even dealing with much more stressful situations. So when we're at the edge of the water, the parts of our brain that process visual information are doing less work. The parts that are processing auditory information, such as language, are doing less work. And if we're in the water, we sort of give up that fight against gravity and the need to balance and coordinate all of the muscles that allow us to do that. So that those parts of our brains are relieved of their active duty, and our brains don't go to sleep. They stay very active, but they switch into a different mode that neuroscientists call the default mode, or the default mode network. And that's a whole different kind of set of brain regions that are much more, much better at sort of self-referential, insightful, contemplative, even creative activities. And sometimes when we're by water, people say they have an aha moment,
yeah,
or the song lyrics or the poem,
right,
or the solution to a problem just seems to fall out of thin air and appear. And great scientists, entrepreneurs, artists, writers, poets, painters, musicians have described that feeling, that appearance of a new idea. And it tends to happen, I'm not going to say exclusively, but water seems to be one of the vehicles that helps us get there.
It's really interesting because I do have this odd craving to be near the ocean from time to time. And I don't know that I've equated it to that, and I certainly don't know that I've ever had any really brilliant specific. I mean, I do. I have. I'm a creative person. I'm a writer, yeah. and you know, I own a business, so there's solutions to be made. But I'm just like sitting here thinking, yeah, maybe this is why I need to go to Del Mar like once or twice a year.
Feel free to use me as an excuse if that's handy.
And last week I had to go to Maine. An issue that came up that caused me to just, like, I needed a timeout. My sister lives in Portland. I wouldn't call it, you know, like, it's not like this beautiful beach, but she's right near the water, and I go and I run right by the water on the Eastern Promenade, and I think my mind cleared. I literally got, you know, the solutions I was looking for.
Yeah, and if you can't get to Maine and you can't get to California,
bathtub,
you know, there are lakes and rivers and bathtubs. And hot tubs and swimming pools, and also there's artwork that you may have collected when you were in Maine that may be hanging on your wall, or home videos or photographs or documentaries. So, you know, I guess that my hope is that this conversation doesn't make people feel worse because they're
inland
for that ocean,
landlocked,
can't quite get there. It could be an urban fountain that you just have to carve out a little bit of time during your lunch break and just go sit by it and pay attention to it and let that work, let that water do its work on you. And it may help you untangle a knot.
Boy, this just explains so much. I have this beautiful 18th century painting in my bedroom, an original, and it's just this ocean. It's just a very active wave. That's it, you know. And I don't know, didn't realize that it might be playing a part in chilling me out. And
that's an important spot in your life to hang a piece of art. You could put nothing there.
Yeah.
You could put something else there. But that's what you chose.
Yeah, see?
And it's probably done some good work subtly over a long period of time.
I'm kind of thinking, yeah. And the other thing that I do, if it's noisy and I want to meditate or relax or even nap, I have one of those white noise things on my Kindle, and I always choose the gentle waves.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure a lot of people could get that on their phones or whatever.
Yeah, it's very accessible. It's very and free. You know, if you don't want to pay 99 cents for an app, you can probably find a version of it that's free, and it's always there. I think that's the reminder, is, you know, do pay attention to the water that's available to you, and use it not for just for hygiene and hydration, although those are two very important things. Also use it to improve your emotional, your psychological, your cognitive and your social life, because it can do that too.
So we don't have a lot of time, but I know that this is just another reason why, and I know that you advocate to help clean up our oceans and help and our waterways. Not only is it just vital for our physical well-being, but there are these other components, which, you know, we're obviously understanding more and more. And one thing I just wanted to ask is, so it is the science that you have to be standing near? You're saying that you can still get an effect from a painting or the sound, a recording. Is that really all just as good as standing near the ocean?
I would say it's not just as good, but it's a continuum.
Okay.
And so, you know, the extreme blue mind experience, I'd say, would be, you know, floating peacefully in the dark in a warm body of water. With no concern of a wave coming over your face or something nibbling your butt, but really just floating in saline water in the dark for as long as you like. That would be the, you know, the extreme on one end. And, you know, a trickle of water, you know, onto your tongue with your thirsty, maybe that's the extreme at the other end, with a very small amount of water But it's a continuum, and it's
right.
You know, it's different for everyone. Some people don't really want to be in the water; they're content to be on the second floor balcony, looking out over it with a margarita. That's their sweet spot. Some people just want to be in it all the time. But you mentioned that, you know, the access component, and access goes away for a number of reasons, including pollution. And if we wreck our waterways, they don't work anymore this way.
Right.
They don't give us hydration and hygiene. They don't give us blue mind. They don't give life. And some people have said, oh, it's just, so you're just saying the surface of the water is all that matters and any water will work. And the answer is no. If the water's dead, it makes you sad.
Yeah.
It may make you angry.
Yeah.
And I call that red mind.
Yeah.
If you go to the beach to chill,
yeah,
and you spend your day cleaning up other people's trash, that doesn't give you blue mind. It gives you red mind.
Yeah.
You resent your fellow humans, and you don't get to relax. And so the whole argument really is about fixing what's broken in terms of our wild waterways, making sure our water is healthy and accessible, so that we can all, you know, of all ages, all kinds of people, can have access to this set of cognitive, emotional, psychological, social, and even spiritual benefits that water does give us all throughout our lives. And an oil spill will take that away real fast.
Oh, Lord, yes. And it is sort of a primal connection. And I know for me, if I hear water, I'm able to access in my mind those times that I was really actually in or near the water. So I'm sure there are ways to sort of access it if you consciously are trying to.
Yeah.
And the one thing, I just had this image when you're talking about being in the dark, in the water, floating. There's a scene in a movie called Immortal Beloved about Beethoven. And he goes deaf, and obviously he goes back in his childhood to a time when his father beat him and apparently boxed his ears one too many times. And during, you know, the Ode to Joy, there's memory of him running as a child down to the river. Now, I don't know if it's real, but the scene, he ends up, you know, escaping his father and running through the woods to this water scene in and it's dark, and all the stars are out, and he just floats in the water. And there's this, you know, who knows what happened, but the scene evokes this sense of it bringing him incredible peace despite the violence and the trauma in his life.
Yeah.
And presumably brought this creative sound to his world.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my God. So if anybody can find that scene, it's
I'll look for it. Right after we get off.
It's brilliant, and it's always stayed in my mind. The movie's, I don't know how old it is now, but I watch the movie periodically for many reasons, but that scene, it really always brings me right to the core of I don't know. So I'm just throwing it out to people.
To your point, Hollywood understands Blue Mind quite well. You know, the epic scene in the film Titanic, where DiCaprio's in the bow saying, I'm king of the world.
Yeah.
He's surrounded by water.
Yeah.
At the end of Shawshank Redemption, Morgan Freeman's character has been dreaming about the blue ocean, and he finally gets there, and that's where the film ends. And they're, you know, from here to eternity, you know, rolling around in the surf and swimsuits. I mean, it just goes on, and water is so much more than hydration and hygiene. It's the emotional matrix of our lives as well, and that goes away when we don't take good care of it, as well as the other uses of water. So that's really the underlying theme of the Blue Mind conversation. And I got to this conversation through sea turtles, and that just happened to be the path I took. But
they're good teachers, apparently.
Yeah, they are fantastic teachers. They're quiet teachers.
Like that scene in Nemo with when they're with the turtles, you know.
That.
So I could talk all day with you. I'm getting all pieced out and blue mind here, but I want to thank you for the work that you're doing in bringing this out. And I know it probably it's a life's work and mission. And I'm grateful because I'm going to start paying attention just a little bit more to the water around me and my callings when I feel drawn to it.
That's great. Yeah, do that. And if you need a creative boost or you need a relaxing moment, consider water as maybe one of your first options, and it will always deliver.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Thank you so much. And people, really, go find his book, Blue Mind, and check out, online, go look up Wallace J. Nichols and learn more. It's very cool. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you. This is great conversation. Really enjoyed it.
To be continued.
Talk to you again.
You've been listening to the Green Divas Radio Show. Be sure to look for this and other Green Diva Network podcasts on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, iTunes, Swell Radio, and Spreaker. Get social with the Green Divas on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Subscribe to the Green Divas YouTube channel to watch them in action. And for all the latest good green news, visit thegreendivas.com. That's THE greendivas.com.